Smiling, she told me that AR had turned down a chance to invest in AB's Irish Rose. I had read about the play. It had opened to scathing reviews and was on the verge of closing when an unnamed investor put up the money to keep the doors open for an extra few weeks. Suddenly, the play caught fire, and the author, Ann Nichols, was a huge success, raking in customers and cash. According to Carolyn, Miss Nichols had offered AR a half interest in the play, which he refused. Boy, was he wrong. It was now past midnight, so I excused myself and climbed the stairs to the fourth floor, admiring the unusual patterns in the rugs, which AR had proudly told me to notice, explaining that the rugs were knotted, not woven, and that they were one of a kind. While undressing, I noticed in the single bookcase a slim volume of proverbs. Immediately, I found myself relating the proverbs to my own life. 1. Better a bad peace than a good war. Given the bad blood between Masseria and AR, I needed to locate the diamond. 2. The biggest ball of twine unwinds. Whoever had taken the diamond would eventually tip his hand. Maybe. 3. Death keeps no calendar. I just wanted to live to be 30, which seemed to me like old age. 4. He that hath children in the crib had best be at peace with the world. I couldn't help but speculate whether this proverb explained the Rothsteins' childless home. 5. No choice is a choice. Boy, did that ever size up my situation. Find the diamond or else. 6. In the mirror, everyone sees his best friend. Maybe Rodman had doubts, but I felt sure that Lily had none. 7. Beware of your friends, not your enemies. When it came right down to it, I trusted only Mom. Pop was dead. 8. Surmise is self-deception. But what else did I have to go on? I had to count on hunches. 9. Talk too much and you talk about yourself. Those words were burned into AR's brain. Talk about secrecy. 10. If you behave like someone else, who's to behave like you? I wanted to be like Lily, dress like her, talk like her, look like her. What harm could there be in that? Closing the book and turning off the light, I lay in bed asking myself, how do you ever know for sure that what you're doing is right? Take AR, for example. He lent money to mugs and violated the Constitution by bringing booze into the country. But banking the crooks reduced their need to break into banks, and bootlegging quenched the thirst of Americans who hated prohibition and loved liquor. So would the world have been better off without him? I'm sure a lot of people without so much as a pause would have said yes, but they saw the world as black and white. My problem was that I saw it in shades. For the next few days, I lived in a whirlwind. Matinee theater performances, movies and restaurants, the warehouse break-in and Rodman's trial. But first things first. Carolyn and I attended a matinee of AB's Irish Rose. The Fulton Theater was packed, and Alfred Wiseman terrific in the role of AB's father. After the performance, I asked Carolyn if she wanted to walk to 84th Street. Arnold hates walking, she said. Let's do. Strolling up Broadway, we chatted about the play. I couldn't help but compare AB and Rose to AR and Carolyn. Both had made mixed marriages. In both, the man came from a Jewish home, the woman from an Irish. The Jewish father was the real screwball when it came to interfaith marriages. He sounded just like AR's old man. If you had kids, I asked, do you think AR and his dad might have kissed and made up? Life isn't like a play, Carolyn replied, an expression of sadness lining her face. Besides, Arnold didn't want any. And you? Very much. Maybe someday, I said stupidly. Taking my hand, she gave it an affectionate squeeze. We said nothing for a long time, and then talked about shoes and chemises till we returned to the house. I felt bad for Carolyn, and for opening my big mouth. As she unlocked the front door, the phone, which never stopped ringing in the Rothstein house, was at it again. I heard her say, "Righto, Bill, I'll do what I can," and hung up. "By any chance, do you know where I can reach Arnold? It's Bill Fallon. He wants to find Rodman and thinks Arnold might know. He says it's important." "As a matter of fact, I have Rodman's card." Emptying my pocketbook, I found it amongst all the junk. 325 West End Avenue, northwest corner of 75th Street. That's just a few blocks away. Bill says he rang the apartment, but no one answered. He might be occupied. What do you mean? Never mind. I'll dash by and see if he's there. When you get back, said Carolyn, we'll have a nice meatloaf. Before leaving the house, I stopped at my room and took Sully's tension wrench and pick. In my imagination, I could see Hank and Lily lazing about, and before I could reach them, someone breaking into the apartment and shooting them both. Given Rodman's business, he could have been plugged or knifed any time. Images from the Saturday movie serials ran through my mind. I would arrive just in time to save them from death. While hurrying from AR's to Hank's, I had the eerie feeling I was being followed. A black Buick slowly made its way down West End Avenue, never getting ahead of me till I darted into Rodman's building and seemed to lose my tail as it moved out of sight. A doorman asked me my business, and I flashed Rodman's card. He gave me a smile and stepped aside. The central hallway, decked out with two swanky red couches, end tables, and Chinese ceramic lamps, was lit by a three-tiered chandelier. Polished marble steps, looking like tombstones, swept upstairs. Ignoring the elevator, I climbed two steps at a time till I reached the third floor. Number 325, at the end of the hall, had a brass number plate on the mahogany door and a small door knocker in the shape of a porpoise. I rapped a few times, but no one responded. The quiet in the hall reminded me of the Undertaker's showroom, where Mum and I picked out a casket for Pop. It gave me the creeps. If I got caught picking the lock, I knew Rodman would come to my aid, and if I didn't get caught and found him inside needing help, I would be a lifesaver. So I tackled the lock, taking about 10 minutes to line up the tumblers. Opening and closing the door with a feathery touch, I tiptoed through the love nest. My imagination had led me astray. No one was home. Like his Long Island estate, the apartment had swank written throughout. Lightaliers with shirred green silk shades and deep fringe hung in both bedrooms, decorated in golden oak with a colonial look. In the larger room, a canopy bed with wooden pulleys to close off the curtains shone under a coverlet of red, blue, yellow, and green crewels, depicting a pastoral scene. A closet held Rodman's clothes and a wardrobe Lily's. I recognized one of her dresses, a pink and white print. The other bedroom, I assume, doubled as an office because it had a desk and wooden filing cabinets. A long, overstuffed couch faced two large wing chairs, each with its own floor lamp. I tried the couch and wondered how often Hank and Lily had enjoyed the spring cushions. Fancying myself a beauty, I pretended I had all the goods. But when I looked in the mirror, I came to my senses. Telephoning Carolyn, I told her to forget about dinner. I wanted to wait a while in hopes of Rodman's return. She thanked me and suggested that if Rodman failed to show, I might try Barney Gallant's nightclub in Washington Square. "Barney's number is unlisted. Arnold has it. Take a taxi. I'll pay." As I hung up, it crossed my mind that AR had the money, Carolyn the generosity. In the bedroom, office, I picked through the drawers, where I uncovered a packet of letters sent from Lily to Hank when he was stationed in France during the war. The ones I read and there must have been more than 100, were pretty hot stuff, but also heartfelt. And here I wish to make a confession. I stole two of the letters, which I own to this day, because I found them so moving. Given how things turned out, I can't say I'm sorry. Haunting memories induced me, now, to reread them again. My dearest Hank, I live from one letter to the next. When the mails are delayed, I imagine the worst. Will this terrible war never end? I read about the trenches and tanks and the gas attacks and the endless amputations. If you were to return without an arm or a leg, how could I stand it? Not for my sake, but for yours. I know you write every day, but your letters sometimes fail to arrive for weeks. And when they do come, they show up in bunches and never in the order you wrote them. I have saved everyone. You know, time has no meaning for me now. It's merely an enormous expanse stretching out endlessly. The days are physical obstacles to being with you. It's very strange to live as I do, so intensely in imagination and memory. I've developed the ability to withdraw at will into daydreams of you. Often I wake up at dinner to find that I've missed everything Mother and Father have said. It's wrong of me, I know, but life when I'm not daydreaming is so painful that the dreams, painful as they are my private relief. The worst days of all are those when I imagine that you found someone else, perhaps a shapely Parisian. Such fears leave me feeling helpless and imprisoned. I ask myself, without Hank, how would I live? What would it mean for our romance to end? For me, it would not be an end to the longing, which is constant, or the loneliness, which is terrible, or the memories, which are beautiful and unendurable. Unendurable because they are so beautiful. The end would mean simply an end to anticipation and hope. And that is the cruelest feeling I can imagine. So I go on longing and remembering and dreaming dreams in which you tell me that I alone live in your heart. Mother has begun to grow impatient with my moods and keeps asking why I don't join my friends at the dances and dinners. I did once, but a hulking halfback from Chicago kept cornering me and pushing his chest against mine while telling me about his college fraternity and his polo ponies. He was awful. Mother knows his family. She keeps saying he'd make a good catch. The first time she said it, I went to my room and cried for an hour. You must hurry home. I can't stand the waiting. As it is, I have to bite my tongue not to offend some of the dim bulbs who come calling. With you, it's so easy. I don't have to rearrange my mind. You make me glad to be what I am, whatever that is. Just this morning, Mother said you were handsome. She also said you were poor. When I told her that you planned to buy a yacht and take people on cruises, she asked if you were really in France or part of Rum Row. I'm afraid she believes only in old money and has no confidence in our being happy unless we are rich. In all honesty, I would hate to be poor. But who wouldn't say the same thing? Reading what I've written so far, I worry that I'm making you sad. So I'll try to cheer you up. There's a journalist you must read. His name's Damon Runyon. Whenever you do your gangster imitations, you sound just like him. Or rather, he sounds just like you. Anyway, I know you'll like what he writes. He's awfully amusing. This comes from him. Of all the scores made by dolls on Broadway the past 25 years, there is no doubt but what the very largest score is made by a doll who is called Maisie Lexington. When she ties the noose with a cheat town playboy by the name of Theodore Bulderoff, for the size of Maisie's score is $3 million and a lifetime of heartburn. I promised Mother I'd join her at Marion, so I really must run. I'll write again tomorrow and tell you if Mother played her tiles well enough to win even a dollar from dear Mrs. Mann. and kissing this letter with my new hot scalding lipstick, a deep red I just bought. If you put your lips on mine, I hope you can feel the current that runs through my body when I'm thinking of you, which is always. Lovingly, Lily. The second letter I had found near the bottom of the packet, and reread that one too. Dear Hank, when I tell you that unless you return immediately we have no future, I'm hurting myself infinitely more than I'm hurting you. You're stronger than I am. You can get along without me. But I am lost without you, and I know it. That is why I'm so frightened. I'm being pointed toward a marriage that I know I'll regret. Unless there is a miracle and I've never known one, Mother and Father will insist I marry Brad Gillespie, the fellow I told you about. They will say that by having entertained him and accepted his gifts, we've led him to believe that his feelings for me are returned. But the more often Brad courts me, the more often I suffer your absence. I do not seem to improve. No project is so absorbing that some part of my mind is not occupied with memories of you. Your ghost is everywhere, reminding me what fun they used to be in a day. I long for your touch so intensely that I begin to think of my longing as a punishment for my having loved you. And nothing is so frightening to me as that all this should be true at the very time I'm pressed to marry another. How could I reconcile my passion for you were I to say yes to Brad? How could I go on, month to month, married to him, all the time yearning for you? Who is to pity us? I've never known it was possible to be so frustrated. All the emotional possibilities you taught me are now a torture. But not for one moment do I regret what we shared, or my decision to give myself to you. My only choice was to affirm life or deny it. To have an affair was to celebrate the changes that had taken place in my life. To keep my distance was to mourn those changes. I chose to celebrate. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to convince myself that our affair was wrong and letting Brad court me is right. But without any guarantee that you'll return and that you'll have the means to support us, I'm asking myself if wanting the ideal isn't self-defeating. I don't know how else to say it. But if you don't return soon, I fear I will have no choice but to marry Brad. His attentions and certainty are pushing me to it. He knows that he wants me, and I am here, and you are there. So he has the advantage. Please, please, please hurry home. If I should prove frail, you have my permission to hate me. But not to forget the great and gentle love I bear you. Desperately yours, Lily.